Hey everybody, it's time for another oneliner.com podcast spectacular. I am, as always, Craig, coming to you from just outside Liverpool, and in Glasgow is site editor Scott Morris.
Hello.
And in Brighton's and Falkirk, as always, is site contributor Drew.
Greetings.
It's been a busy couple of weeks at the cinema since we spoke to you last. We're going to be looking at a slew of films tonight, not least of all Righteous Kill, Death Race and Taken, so amongst others. So without further ado, we will crack on and let's see what we thought. It strikes me that if you took Al Pacino and Bob De Niro and sat them in a room and said, what film would you like to make? They could pretty much demand any script from any writer and any director and any amount of money to make it, such as the demand that that film would probably generate. In the end, De Niro and Pacino have settled on Righteous Kill from writer Russell Givertz and director John Avnet. Bit of a strange choice, as it boils down to little more than a B-movie cop potboiler. Guys, I was comparatively underwhelmed by Righteous Kill, but it seems to have had a bad deal in the press lately. Scott, can you run down the basic premise?
Well, you've essentially described the basic premise. It's a more or less bottom-of-the-barrel script with prompts nothing more than mild disinterest. It's a serial killer doing the rounds in Detective Pacino and De Niro's neck of the woods, bumping off minor criminals of the sort that no one seems particularly perturbed to see gone, yet they're still assigned to catch this evildoer, joined on the way by fellow coppers Donnie Wahlberg and John Leguizamo. Off they plod down a cookie-cutter serial killer investigation route of the sort you've seen umpteen times before, and it does very little to distinguish itself from any of the others. I mean, it's the sort of film, if it had come out about 20 years ago, it would probably have been mildly interesting and met with a bit more success. It might at least have had performances from Pacino and De Niro that didn't come across as, well, entirely detached. Didn't seem to care very much about this at all. The casting doesn't even feel particularly appropriate. It seems to be a role for two 40-year-old cops played by two 60-odd-year-old people, and it just seems very out of place. Like, as that the opening credit sequence shows them at the firing range firing off automatic weapons and chuckling like schoolboys, it just looks like two very old men firing about. It just trying to show them how badly miscast they are.
If anything, I quite enjoyed that aspect of it, though, because there are scenes where you get the sense, you know, they have a bit of a sort of laddish chuckle every now and again, and the whole film plays out a little bit like a retirement fund for both of the actors involved. But you do get the sense that at least along the way they were having a couple of shits and giggles about it.
Well, here's the thing, I mean, between them and the support as well is fine. There's enough talent in the cast to make it sort of watchable. I can kind of let it away with being sort of underwhelming. It does still have a cast that you can at least identify with because they've been in so many good films before. But if you look at the film itself, it's clearly B-movie quality stuff. It's of very little interest to distinguish itself from anything else that I've seen lately. It's not dreadful, but I can't really think of any reason to actually recommend it to anyone, if you know what I'm saying.
Drew, are your thoughts in concurrence with that, or do you have anything different to say?
It's hugely underwhelming. It's very much on the poor side of mediocre. And it's almost, it is frustrating that De Niro and Pacino seem so disinterested. And it's something that spreads the rest of the cast too. And Donnie Wahlberg has got a pretty solid reputation now for character roles, and even he can't get any interest in it. Yeah. And it just seems that the names attached are just way above the quality of the script, and they're aware of it and don't really care.
There are moments, I mean, as I say, it's in a sense it's nice to see these two old guys having a bit of a chuckle, but there are moments where you think, oh, come on, actually, you're sitting there having a chuckle at the fact I just paid £7 to come and see this, aren't you, really? Do you know, the biggest problem for me, I can deal with the whole sort of substandard script and whatnot, because there was enough going on to sustain it for the runtime, but it all seemed to pivot on this supposed twist at the end, which when it occurs kind of undermines everything that's gone before it and makes this everything that's preceded all of a sudden seem a little bit contrived. And I'd actually enjoyed it reasonably up to that point and then just felt as if the rug had been pulled out from under my feet.
I would screw that, because I was certain that was coming from the beginning, because the way this started, they're clearly they're starting off saying that this has happened. Oh, clearly can't have done.
Yeah.
There was no craft in the film at all. It was very, very perfunctory.
Quite workmanlike.
Yeah, very productive. There's no craft in it, so the twist was, it's just, oh, it was a stupid and pointless twist, but it was so obviously coming, and it's why I found myself having very, very little interest in what was going to happen during the rest of the film, because I was absolutely certain how it would turn out, and unfortunately I was right. I would love to have been surprised.
It's a bit of a disappointment from a scripting side, because Russell Govert's previous film was Inside Man from 2006, which I'm assuming you guys saw. It wasn't a bad piece of writing at all.
No, but it was quite enjoyable if my addled memory serves. I quite like that film.
I think perhaps the one thing that Tainted left a taste in the mouth a bit longer than most of the other aspects of the film was surely the sight of a rubbery Robert De Niro humping a beautiful Carla Gugino. I didn't need to see that.
Yes, could have done without that.
It's brief, but it's certainly enough to stick in the mind.
Yes.
Sorry, Drew, you were going to add something.
I was going to say, when you were saying about the script writer, I think perhaps, as we'll discuss in the film we're going to talk about shortly, that a lot of the pedestrian nature of it could well be down to the director, because he's managed to spurn Al Pacino in yet another film that we've watched for this podcast.
He certainly has, so I think yes.
A lot of...
Last year in the States, I think, wasn't it? But
yeah, but it was out in the cinema at the same time here, both films showing last weekend, and I think a lot of the blame lies at John Avnet's feet.
Well, again, it's a bit of a shame, because Avnet has, on his previous credentials, at least one Oscar-nominated film in the shape of Fried Green Tomatoes, which I haven't seen, but I remember a talk of it from a while back, and it certainly seemed to garner enough praise at the time.
I have seen that film, and it's not particularly my cup of tea, but it's well acted. Again, I think that was a lot to the cast be more enthused, and the fact that the source is a well-regarded novel. So I think perhaps that's played more of a part there.
I think there's a bit of a clue in that he seems to have spent his time in between flitting back and forward, but mostly in TV rather than the big screen. And at times it does kind of come across a little bit Righteous Kill as a sort of Sunday afternoon special, but given a bit more of a budget, which is a shame, but it perhaps explains it a little bit. But I suppose there are probably worse things you could stumble into in your cinema if you went out not knowing what you were going to see beforehand, but not one to go out of your way for, I would say. Now, Drew, you just touched upon there the other film starring Al Pacino and directed by John Avnet, which was out previously, I think, last year in US cinemas, but which has made an appearance this week alongside and presumably off the back of Righteous Kill, and that is 88 Minutes. Could you give us a quick plot recap?
I shall try my best. Al Pacino plays Dr. Jack Graham, a forensic psychiatrist and psychologist whose expert testimony in a murder trial had seen Neil McDonough's John Forster sentenced to death for the murder of a woman in a particularly unpleasant manner. And ever since then, Forster has maintained his innocence. And on the day where he is meant to be executed, Dr. Graham starts receiving death threats and is told that he has 88 minutes to live. And then he runs about trying to find out who's killing him and why.
and why so specifically within a certain time frame.
Yes. Not that that's ever answered, though.
Oh, fair enough.
It seems to be an
answer. It does get answered, but answered in a way that doesn't make any sense, because it would only ever be understandable to...
Oh, yes, sorry. It does. It's his sister, yes. I forgot about that.
I don't think it'd be pointless.
That's how much impact that particular reason for the 88 minutes made on me that I've entirely forgot why it was there. There's no good reason to call the film 88 minutes.
It's an interesting gimmick to hang a film around, if nothing else, and it is pretty much nothing else.
And so guys, you weren't that impressed by Righteous Kill. Is this a notch up or a significant notch down?
Oh, this is a significant notch down. Oh, yes. Once again, as with Righteous Kill, Al Pacino looks very bored, and he knows this work is far, far below him, but presumably he had a yacht to pay for or something, as is often the case with these egregious performances. But this time, while he looks bored, everybody else in it is actively bad, and completely throughout the entire cast, almost to a person, they are awful. I mean, with particular notes to Alicia Witt and his student Lauren Douglas, played by Lily Sobieski. They are particularly awful.
That comes as a surprise, because I'm just looking at the... I mean, I haven't seen the film, but I'm just looking at the cast list here, and the first thing I've noticed is that the great majority of the top-billed cast is female, and there are a few names in there that you would think could be trusted, such as Alicia Witt and Lily Sobieski, and further down the list, Deborah Kara Unger.
Dreadful.
They're all, I mean, it's actively bad. It's probably the worst ensemble acting appearance, acting I've seen in quite some time, if ever. The whole cast is so universally poor.
Good grief. Sounds like a car crash.
Unfortunately, a particularly stupid plot doesn't make up for it at all.
It interests me that Pacino puts his name to this kind of thing, and De Niro's just as guilty as well. It strikes me as being something of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because these guys surely, at any point prior to this, can lay their hands on and simply take any script they want that's kicking about Hollywood. And so why would they choose to do these films? And given that they've had a bit of a run of them lately, people are going to turn around and say, actually, we don't remember you being a good actor to start with. We're only going to offer you shit scripts from now on. I can't understand what's happening here.
Well, it's baffling. I cannot think that anyone would pick up this script, read it and think, oh, that makes sense. It's one of these scripts that just simply does not know when to stop, and it keeps piling on increasingly sillier layers on top of a silly layer to start with. And by the end of it, you've got this, you've got attempted hits in his life, you've got bomb threats, car bombs, and it gets to the point where it's almost like it'd be unfitting if Jack Ram was strapped to a nuclear weapon and launched out of a B-52.
Yeah, and just to illustrate the lack of narrative logic in it in terms of what the character's any character's likely to do. Jack Graham's consistently threatened with, you've got 88 minutes to live, and there's a few bits where there's an effective countdown. He receives a message saying, it's now 62 minutes, Dr. Graham. And then, having had his life almost taken on a number of occasions, it's phoned up by the killer, who gives him no reason to do so, but says, you're going to die in 6 minutes, meet me at this building. Surely the obvious thing to do would just be no. Say no.
I think I know what this guy's going to do when I get there.
You've got 6 minutes to live. You're going to die in 6 minutes. Please come here. Well, fuck yourself. Is the appropriate response, surely. No, okay then, I'll be there shortly.
I mean, it surprises me because, like I say, it was released last year and we've all heard the sort of critical reaction to it well in advance. And what on earth has made Al Pacino say, okay then, not only that, but I'll do another film with you. And not only that, I'm going to drag my pal Bobby De Niro, you might have heard of him, I'm going to drag him along for the ride as well. His career needs a bit of a busting.
I can only assume they are taking the piss.
Yeah, you remember in the mid-1990s when De Niro and Pacino, although they never were actually on screen together, were going to be in the same film together at the same time in Heat. And there was so much hype around that, and like, finally these two greats are going to be on screen together. And then in this year, it happens again, and then they come out with this pish.
Well, they were together for a few minutes in Heat in two scenes, weren't they? But it was kind of a letdown given the... Well, in a sense, though, maybe Michael Mann saw this sort of thing coming. Maybe he saw the potential for a train wreck at some stage of them coming together, and he thought, well, actually, no, we'll restrict it to a couple of minutes and no more. And I don't know, maybe it was one of the most astute decisions any director has ever made. But, I mean, what a world difference between something like Heat and something like Righteous Kill. My God, I don't know. I'm in shock still.
Well, let's just get this out of the way first. We have now seen two films with Al Pacino in it, and one film with Al Pacino and Bob De Niro in it. And both of these films are worse than a Paul W.S. Anderson film we'll talk about later.
I do believe that's a sign of the apocalypse.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what, Les, off the back of that comment, let's deal with that. Let's deal with that very film you're going to talk about.
Deal with that bombshell.
Let's deal with that bombshell. Come on, let's get this out in the open. The elephant is in the room. Let's talk about it. Paul W.S. Anderson has indeed another film in multiplexes this week, and in light of his previous track record on such genius fare as the Resident Evil films and the first Alien versus Predator, it's amazing if anybody by this point has has not been inoculated against his particular brand of filmmaking and will stumble in to see Death Race, a remake of the Roger Corman film, I believe, from 1975, and starring, was it David Carradine?
David Carradine and Sylvester Stallone.
In an awesome hat running over old ladies. What's not to love?
What's not to love, indeed. Very loosely, the tale, I do mean loosely, the premise of the film revolves around a point in the near future at which the American economy has collapsed and penal systems have
Next Thursday.
the next Thursday, yes, currently. It's not as far in the future as you may think. I wouldn't be surprised if the DVD release has that title card brought forward in date slightly. Private corporations run the penal correction centres, and, well, the best way to make any money back is to televise convicts driving into each other at high speed in souped-up and be-weaponed cars. I've got to admit that Death Race is one of those cult films. I remember a few years back I was quite looking forward to catching up with when that sort of thing was high up on my list of priorities, and when I saw it I thought, my goodness, what a pile of steaming crap this is. So the news that Paul W.S. Anderson was going to remake it, I didn't have high hopes, but I believe you two gents found it at least mildly enjoyable.
Very little plot to recap other than that. Statham, our old friend Jason, is put in there for the proverbial crime that he did not commit, and that's essentially your hook. You have the evil prison warden, for some reason is evil, and Statham's attempting to rebel against that particular system. But essentially you've got half an hour of fairly tedious setup. It's not great. But then after that, it's just lots of fast cars driving about and shooting each other and blowing things up, and it's all fun in a sort of Xboxy sort of way. I mean, it's by no means a classic, but it's not terrible. It's quite a lot of fun, actually, when you're sat there watching it. It's paced relatively enough. There's the odd aside from Lovejoy, which keeps things going, ticking over nicely. I can't sit here and tell you it's a good film in the way that Citizen Kane's a good film, but in terms of brainless, blockbustery type action fare, it's certainly not the worst I've seen this year.
Is it not a car called Rosebud in there somewhere?
Scott's hitting the right word there, which is brainless, which is what I wanted before we saw it. I had a choice of a couple of films to see first that weekend, and it was that or Righteous Kill, so I thought, I want something brainless. And I picked that, and I'm glad I did.
You've had a week of brainless, haven't you, really? Your trip's to the
It is just that if you just want something where you can switch off your brain, not have to think and worry about the plot not making sense, because it's a fairly basic plot, and if you just want something sort of loud and crashy, bangy, and enjoyable, but it's fluff, but very entertainingly so, as opposed to, say, Anderson's previous work like Resident Evil, which is just rotten. It's actually, as a piece of fluff just to disengage your brain for 90 minutes, it works very, very well.
I tell you, there's only one disappointment that I have in this film, and it's that Jason doesn't have a comedy foreign accent, which I've got to rely on.
No, that's the one
that
good
pleases
point.
Me.
Yes, I mean, I did start to watch Death Race, but unfortunately the prior commitment of closing my eyelids and going to sleep at some point over the past 2 days got in the way. But two things stuck out. The first thing that stuck out was, what the hell is Joan Allen doing playing some crazy prison warden?
And
Hennessy. And oh my God, Jason Statham's in an American-funded film without some cheesy accent. That pleased me. It's not something that I enjoy having to rely on, as walking in and listening to Jason Statham going like this for 2 hours.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's hilarious when you do an impersonation of it, but it's not hilarious to see.
Yeah, I suppose.
See him on, you know, 20 feet tall on a screen talking like that. So, is it going to be worth my while actually going back and catching up with Death Race then, guys?
It depends on your mood. If you just want, if you've got easy access to it and you just want something to relax about and not have to concentrate hard on, then it's ideal, really. It's 90 minutes just knockabout enjoyment.
Well, while we're on the subject of 90 minutes of knockabout enjoyment and brainless fun, I did see at least one film this week that falls into that category, so it seems like we're spoilt for choice for that sort of thing. That would be Taken. It's directed by Pierre Morel, whose previous film was District 13, a fun enough urban free-running stroke kung fu kick shit out of him up. And it's been written by Luc Besson, which unfortunately...
No, it's from the mind of Luc Besson.
Right, sorry. I forget how Luc Besson likes these things to be phrased. It's from the mind of Luc Besson, which one wonders why you would be that specific when it stopped being a seal of quality about 10 years ago. it's a very nominal film in all respects. And it seems...
It's a plot setup of one sentence, isn't it?
It certainly has. Liam Neeson is a former American special agent whose daughter is kidnapped by a bunch of Europeans. Liam Neeson threatens to kill them all, and he does just that. That's
man
literally
keeps his promises.
That's literally as deep as it gets. Now, I fully expected to be shocked by this, and in a sense I was, because I'd heard well in advance of the film's entrenched racism. Especially, though, bizarrely against French people, seemingly, which is seems a bit odd, and it makes me wonder whether the mind of Luc Besson has either finally gone round the bend, or he's playing, he's willfully playing on conventions of American action cinema and its perception of foreigners, because it takes place for the most part in a Paris which appears to have come off a postcard from 1965, where where no street corner is left untouched by mime artists and fucking onion sellers. And literally people are walking about carrying baguettes and things like that. I have to say, I fully expected it to be atrocious, and it was, but it was atrocious in the same sense that made, Scott, you mentioned before we started recording the Commando connection, and it literally is sort of a Gallic version of Commando with an American lead and no sense of humour.
It's more with people getting punched in the face rather than getting shot, but other than that, it's...
Well, he does manage to shoot a fair few, though.
There's a lot at the end, but it's...
Including a woman who had nothing to do with it.
Well, she got in the way.
He had it covered.
But choice of pain delivery vectors aside, it's pretty much Commando again. But it took some flack for being somewhat exploitative in terms of violence. But like I say, it's all very 80s.
It's not actually as violent as I expected, given the word of mouth as well. I thought it would be a lot more shocking.
I mean, if you've seen any 80s action film, then this will seem awfully tame in comparison. But what it does is it's a really well-paced action film. It's, like I say, it's all very Bourne Identity style cutting, or indeed District 13, if you've seen that. It bombs along at a remarkable pace, and Neeson himself always seems fairly convincing, despite the fact that it is a very silly setup, but he always seems fairly convinced of what he's doing, and that lends it just enough credibility to butch out its slightly sillier aspects and just channel through for 90 minutes of pure staving people's faces in fun.
It certainly does what it says on the tin. And while I'm not as convinced about Liam Neeson's acting chops these days, let me tell you, as a former boxer, he can still hold his own when it comes to the fight scenes.
Yeah, that's believable, isn't it? He's got the real physicality there, and his height helps too. But it's like, you just kind of believe they can take these people on, which some actors can't really pull off. So, nah, they'd get minced, but you can believe it with Neeson.
He's got that thing in his eyes as well, and I know this sounds a little bit cheesy, but I remember when GoldenEye first came out, and Barbara Broccoli had said that one of the reasons he chose Pierce Brosnan was that although he was an affable character, when he's in a bit of a mood, you look at him and you think, no, actually, he's got a look about him. He does actually convince me that he could kill a man. But crank that up to 10. Let me tell you, when Liam Neeson rather casually tells the guy down the phone immediately after his daughter's kidnapped that I will come to France, I will find you, and I will kill you. I take Liam Neeson seriously on all counts. I wouldn't want to spill Liam Neeson's pint, let alone kidnap his daughter. But it's the kind of film that pleases me in a sense that I've kind of gotten to the age now, and I have the faculties now where I assume this sort of thing is just going to be shallow, and I'm going to be unable to enjoy it as much as I would like to enjoy the sort of prototypical male revenge fantasy setup that's so appealing when you're a 10-12-year-old lad. But it was passable enough. I certainly didn't notice the time flying in. It's not going to pick up any awards, but I don't know.
No, I thought exactly the same thing. I mean, it is a film which absolutely flew by. There are films that seem to drag, and quite a lot of them lately seem to drag and outstay their welcome, whereas this just zips through and goes away. It never outstays its welcome. It knows what it wants to do and does it very well. And that's about all you can ask for it, really.
Yeah, I'd be very interested to take a peek inside the mind of Luc Besson. I'd love to sit him down and say, Luc, were you trying to take the piss out of American action cinema with this? Or, you know, is this really just you sticking two fingers up at Americans? I honestly don't get it. It's absolutely bizarre, but, you know, Holly Valance's pointless appearance aside... If the only thing I can think to say about it is that it's absolutely shallow beyond belief, but it doesn't pretend to be anything else.
There are people that say that there's no place for that in cinema, but I think there is. I think this is fun. It's not particularly big or clever, but it's a lot of fun. And
it's well done. Yeah, it's well done. That's the point too. I mean, there's no place for it if you're just going to not do it properly, but you do as well as this done.
The only advice I'd give is I wouldn't make it a first date film.
No.
Well, possibly because she would turn off your date should you she see you're enjoying quite so much seeing somebody get punched in the face repeatedly.
Yes.
Or as I was going, ha ha ha, you opened the door and got shot.
Oh dear. So darling, what film would you like to take us to tonight? Well, I thought we'd go and see this one where Liam Neeson takes a knife off a man, drives it into his chest, and then repeatedly knees it further in. Fantastic.
It's a sensitive exploration of someone's liver.
Yes. Let's go and see a film where Liam Neeson takes umbrage at a man, and so he shoots his wife just to annoy him. Yeah, there you go. Taken. If you want to see some people getting their head staved in, knock yourself out. There's a fair old chance if, like me, late at night working away, you keep your TV switched on Dave for repeats of QI, that you may have seen a trailer for The Mutant Chronicles, which seems to have more than the faintest whiff of low-budget sci-fi serenity mimicry about it. But, Drew, is that the case, or is Mutant Chronicles actually a big-budget spectacle of sci-fi superbness?
No.
No. Well, tell us what it's about, then.
Story runs thus. Back in the days of yore, a big machine fell from the sky and fucked our shit up, transforming humans into ugly mutants with massive, stabby, pointy arms, which they used to stabby the rest of the humans. They were driven back by some old warrior geezer sealed under the earth and largely forgotten about, apart from Brother Samuel, Ron Perlman's Order of Warrior Monks. Now, in some bleak 1984-style dystopian futurescape where corporations run the earth and yada yada yada, some 1914-style eternal war, blah blah blah, a few stray shells crack open this seal, and before you know it, the planet's full of stabby, stabby mutants again, and Sean Pertwee's been dragged away into the heart of this machine. Cue Brother Samuel and getting all tooled up and assembling a pleasingly multicultural assault team to sneak into the heart of this machine, disable it in accordance with some vague instructions from some Bible of mutant killing, led largely by Major Mitch Hunter, Thomas Jane, along with a supporting cast that it's very clear from the outset aren't going to survive until the end credits. As a setup for a sci-fi action hokum, there's not much not to love about this. Stabby mutants and high-caliber weaponry. What could go wrong? Well, plodding of pacing and somewhat iffy effects. Let's look at that iffy effects statement first. It's from the sort of Sky Captain 300 Casern sort of school of virtual sets and effects that sort of sit halfway between reality and animation.
Is that more of a function of it not having a budget, though? And it's cheaper to do stuff in CG than actually pay a carpenter these days.
Well, very probably. I mean, it does look an awful lot like an Xbox 360 first-person shoot-em-up. It's ugly, but I suppose it has to be ugly. I mean, that's sort of the point of...
it's about stabby mutants, things. Yeah.
I mean, slightly iffy effects, and some of the compositing's, I don't know if it's sort of stylistically odd rather than simply bad. If you can, it kind of makes sense in the context of the film, but it does look dismal in trailers, I have to admit. That's not so much an issue for me. I can forgive bad effects works if it's the rest of the film is good enough, but this simply isn't. It's really quite dull, which is something of a surprise in a film where this many people get stabbed in the face with metal spikes. It somewhat strings you along a bit, promising it to turn into some really bombastic style action film, and it never does, and it just kind of plods along and eventually seems about five times longer than it actually is. Other than that, I mean, the acting's passable enough for this sort of thing. The problems that Mutant Chronicles have has nothing to do with believability of the characters. It's just that it's very, very dull. Not quite sure what I expected going into this, and I feel slightly, I don't know, in two minds about sitting here slagging it off too badly, because I will sit here on my big fat ass for any number of films saying, oh, this has no scope, it has no vision, it doesn't take any risks, and it's rehashing the same old nonsense, and this is something that, for its faults, it does have a genuine vision, it does have some kind of scope, it does have a sense of where it wants to go, it's just a shame that it can't actually get there. And also that it's Boz.
A shame, really, but we're just reading here that it's based on a pen and paper role-playing game from Sweden. So, you know, if you have a penchant for that sort of thing, then you may well enjoy it. But I'm certainly not going to go out of my way to see it, but that's probably mostly because I was put off by the shitty trailers.
I'd say that's absolutely the right choice.
Can I also give a special shout-out to our fellow Scotsman, Colin MacArthur, who I've just been chuckling at here, for his IMDb user comments, which state that he watched this film because, and I quote, Ron Perlman's in it, and I'm always buoyed by seeing a man who looks like a gorilla act so well. Way to go, Colin. I won't be joining you in your praise of Ron Perlman just yet, but there you go. If you like shoddy sci-fi shit, go and see the Mutant Chronicles. I can't imagine it being any worse than most of the other stuff out, so go for it. Now, normally in a week as bad as this, we'd like to save the best for last, but by all accounts, the best this week isn't that easily separated from the worst. So without further ado, how to make friends and alienate people. Scott, what's that all about?
It is, I suppose, something of a departure for Simon Pegg, in as much as it's something that's not either originally conceived or hastily retrofitted as a Simon Pegg vehicle. Not that there's anything wrong with Simon Pegg vehicles, you understand. They're normally smooth, entertaining rides. In fact, I'd rather wish this film was more of a standard Simon Pegg vehicle, because How to Lose Friends and Alienate People often struggles to get out of first gear. Do you see what I did there?
That passed.
This is one of those true, for the usual cinematic values of true, i.e. adapted out of all recognition, stories of Sidney Young, an English celeb scandal hack. It's based on Toby
Young.
His memoirs and sort of bodged together into a film. He's an English celeb scandal hack who goes off to work for a respected American glossy, presenting the usual fish out of water scenario as the Englishman, and I just noted my notes have written English ham, which is amusing. But as the Englishman struggles to fit into his new surroundings and work out that to progress up the ladder, he'll have to abandon his usual fairly lax, it must be said, standards of journalism, and churn out smoke-blowing puff pieces. And at this point, I'm starting to get flashbacks to the plot of The Devil Wears Prada, so I'll abandon talking about that immediately. The other aspect of the film concerns Sidney's love life, his growing friendship with his direct boss, Alison, played by Kirsten Dunst, conflicting with his schoolboy lust after hot young actress Sophie Mays, played by Megan Fox, and who can blame him? Both of these ambitions are hampered by Sidney being a complete tool. Not enough of a complete tool to evoke hatred, you understand. It is a romantic comedy, after all, but more in the kind of cringeworthy Ricky Gervais off The Office sort of way. It's just enough to make his final real return to the light side of the Force vaguely believable, but it's not particularly compelling. Now, let me just break this up for a minute. I'll list the rest of the supporting cast. You've got Gillian Anderson, Jeff Bridges, and Danny Houston. So I'm now getting flashbacks to Love Actually, in as much as it's the same trick of throwing a lot of talented cast at a film and hoping that they can cover up some pretty glaring faults in the script. In both cases, it sort of works. This is an entertaining enough film. It's somewhat overlong. It does feel a bit stretched out towards the end of it, but it's certainly not a chore to sit through. What it's not, though, is particularly funny. Most of its attempts at humour involve Simon Pegg dancing badly, falling over, or preferably both at the same time. In large part, it's entertaining enough, but I didn't laugh very much when I was watching it, and that's something of an issue in a comedy. It pains me to say it, but I found the Paul W.S. Anderson film more fun than this, and I feel very dirty.
It strikes me as a somewhat odd choice, not just in the casting, but just in how the film's been pitched, because Toby Young's adventures in America were decidedly downbeat, and the man came back changed from having sort of been quite a narcissistic prick by all accounts to having been humbled somewhat by the beating he took over there. It certainly doesn't strike me, and his memoirs, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, of his time, certainly don't have a reputation for being a light and fluffy romantic comedy, which is what this film is pitched as. Now, what on earth has made them make that decision?
To get audiences to see it.
It
has been adapted out of all recognition by pretty much all accounts. It's a reasonable film that has the same name as a book.
Well, why would Toby Young put his name to it? It's bizarre.
I would imagine because he gets paid.
Oh, Toby. I mean, it's currently astride the top of the UK box office for whatever that's worth on a global scale. But I can't help but think that it's probably entirely off the back of the casting of Simon Pegg, who most people think can do no wrong. But I don't know, Star Trek better pull it out of the bag, because the reviews he's had for this have him as woefully miscast on account of most newspaper reviews I've read so far. Is that the case? No. Does he struggle quite a bit in the role, Drew?
Oh, I wouldn't say it's miscast. I think the fact that it's Simon Pegg actually is the only thing that saves it, because the character's just a completely unlikable wanker, which is an odd choice for characters in a romantic comedy. Because there's not really a lot of reason to care about him or want him to get the girl in the end.
And it sets up the possibility of redemption. Oh, no, wait a minute, he's just a prick.
Yep, that's it. It's just the fact that it's Simon Pegg and he comes across as likeable because he's Simon Pegg is the only reason you care about the character at all. So he's not so much miscast as a saviour for the role, because it would have been really, really dire, as opposed to just crap if he hadn't been there at all.
I'm not convinced Pegg's escaped the trick of being typecast as himself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has basically played more or less the same kind of characters through space than all the Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, that sort of thing. Run, Fat Boy, Run, he's playing much the same character. Now, when he tries to play something else, it seems that because he's not playing Simon Pegg anymore, he's not playing ball with what we're expecting. I don't know, it'll only take a couple of good films to pan it out. If Star Trek does actually knock it out of the park and he produces a convincing Scotty, I think that'll sort of put paid to this, but he's in a bit of a limbo at the moment, I think, until he can prove that he can not be Simon Pegg, if you see where I'm coming from with that.
Yeah,
this is obviously the film with which he's hoping to crack the American market. I mean, is it likely to do that for him, or has he shot himself in the foot here?
It's just not good enough. It's not particularly funny.
It's dull, it's not funny, the character's unlikable, there's not really much to recommend at all.
Yeah.
Oh dear Simon, wherefore you done so bad?
I guess in that case then, are we rounding out this by admission that Death Race has been the film of the week? Is that the situation we're faced with? Oh my God.
I prefer Taken to Death Race.
I would put Taken above Death Race, but I mean, that's surely comment worthy enough in itself. Paul W.S. Anderson film, not the worst.
Yes. Yeah. So there you go, folks. Our incisive, laser sharp wit and critical faculties have been focused on the cinematic offerings this week, and we have decided that. I can't believe it, but your best bet down at the cinema is Eurotrash thriller Taken from the mind of Luc Besson. And if you can't face that, the not worst film of the week, which you're going to want to go and see as a second choice, is a Paul W.S. Anderson film.
Good
grief. I may struggle to comprehend this week for quite some time. I feel like I need to go and lie down and convince myself something.
Let us never talk of it again.
Is this the reason why the economy's gone to pot? I can't think of an immediate link, but it's one of those scenarios where I'm thinking to myself, it's all got to be interconnected. Thanks for putting up with our rantings again, as always. We'll be back with you as soon as we possibly can be to cast our glaring eye over the next crop of cinema releases. But until then, I've been Craig Eastman, and in Glasgow, as always, with Scott Morris.
Keep it real, peeps.
And leaving you, but certainly no less loving you, from Falkirk, Drew Tavendale.
Keep it vaguely imaginary.
Solid steel. See you later, guys.
I hate you, butler. Get them buses out.